And with Mark Brody in Phoenix, I'm Steve Goldstein. It is now time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I pray for the day in Arizona that these families do not have to continue to come to committee and tell of the tragedies that their loved ones faced.
It seeks to create a uniform law that would be statewide, superseding all other municipalities, which would give all of our motorists, as well as our business owners and everyone else, the ability to know exactly what our laws are from one city to another city.
Obviously, that's up to him, but it seems to me, given that there is uncertainty in the law, that taxpayers deserve to have extra time. They don't have to wait until June 15th. They could certainly file, and many will, many are. But those who are wanting to take a wait-and-see approach, and I would count myself among them, deserve that certainty before they have to file their taxes.
The truth is, despite what you may hear from some of those that oppose the president's border security agenda on Capitol Hill, this is a crisis the likes of which we've never seen before.
And with us to talk about Arizona moving closer to a texting and driving ban, along with the Phoenix mayor's race and the home stretch and more, our public policy consultant Chris Hurstam and editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com, John Gabriel. Guys, welcome back. Thanks
Good
for being
morning.
Here.
Thank you.
So, Chris, texting and driving. I actually got a note from someone this morning who saw a little note I put up on Twitter and said, wait a second, Arizona doesn't have a texting and driving ban, so what is driving us to actually make progress on this issue right now?
Well, the fact is we haven't made progress for many years. AAA, the Arizona Automobile Association, has been lobbying at the Capitol for many years for this, and I think to illuminate us, we need to remember there's only two states in the country, Missouri and Montana, that do not already have a statewide ban on texting while you're driving. So we are, as usual, very late to come to the party here. And tragically, it's when lives are lost, such as the peace officer, Salt River peace officer that was killed. That was sort of like the last straw and the last bit of ammunition that's been used to get this through. So it's great that it's happening, bravo, but boy, it could have been done many years earlier.
Now, John, because you're the resident libertarian on the panel, because we have to label people, of course, so what do you feel about, is there that concern about, even as Chris says, the logic seems odd when we're just one of three states, but is there something to be said about mommy state, why are police telling me what I can do in my car?
Right. Well, for the record, I was not flipping through anything on my phone on the drive here. If anyone's listening, that's important. I think the argument against it is just that it's difficult to enforce. However, since many municipalities have already have this kind of law, I just assume it's illegal wherever I'm driving because I don't know the status in Tempe to Mesa to Gilbert to Chandler or wherever else I might be driving. So I think most people have been driving like that anyway. I also have two daughters who, if I tried to pull out my phone, I will get a long lecture from them. So it's just not in my interest. So the younger generation is already acclimated to not doing that, let's hope at least.
You know, it's funny that libertarian argument of big government, keep your hands off our private situation. I'm old, so I'm going to reminisce. But in 1983, when I was a freshman legislator, the very first bill that I ever sponsored as a prime sponsor was the mandatory use of child restraint seats in automobiles. And that had failed for many years. And I heard the exact same type of arguments. This is up to parents to do this. And the government shouldn't be trying to be the big brother or the big sister and take care of people and so forth. And, time goes by and, it's just consistent. But when it comes to the endangering human life because of these activities, it's appropriate to step in and do this. And as I said, I just wish Arizona would have done it years ago.
John, I'm curious about the idea that some critics of the bill have made that, yes, texting is dangerous when driving. I'm not sure anybody's making the argument that it's okay to be doing that. But, reading the newspaper while you're driving is not a great idea. Shaving, putting on makeup, eating, a lot of the other things that people also do while driving are not necessarily safe. Is there something about texting that is inherently more dangerous, or is it sort of a political thing that it's just easier to say, this is something that we can all get behind that you shouldn't do, whereas these other ones might be tougher to actually ban?
Yeah, I think it's tougher for a policeman on the beat to identify if somebody's reading the paper or just moving it from one place to another. In college, one of my roommates, this is how cool I was, he used to do the New York Times Sunday crossword while he was driving. It would be suspended on the steering wheel. I would often ask to drive instead. So distracted driving has a long history, even among very uncool people like my friends. I think this is actually legislation that has caught up to the public mood in this case. I don't think it's something that will make much difference in people's lives. It'll just give another tool in the toolbox of our law enforcement if somebody is in an accident or driving dangerously to hold them accountable.
Well, Chris, how much of a difference do you think, assuming this bill goes into law, the governor has said that he is supportive of it, assuming it gets through the legislature. Distracted driving, as critics of these kinds of bills point out, is already illegal. How much difference will a specific texting while driving ban bill law make, do you think?
I think it will have a great impact. All it'll take is just a few stops by the police and fines and so forth, and the word will spread pretty quickly. And I think this bill will get a lot of publicity. And, you know, basically I think folks like me, for instance, who has that phone too close to them when they're driving, are going to finally put it away is what they're going to do. They're going to turn it off or put it away or put it in a hands-free device, and because they just aren't going to want to take a chance for getting a fine like that. So I think it will have an impact.
Now, coming up later in the newscap, we're going to talk about the Phoenix mayor's race. We're just a few days away from that. But one other legislative issue I wanted to bring up. John, let me start with you. It's David Stringer. It's when this investigation, ethics investigation, is done. Now, ethics chair in the House, T.J. Shope, is saying he doesn't want a circus. He doesn't really want this sort of major ethics hearing. And that is causing a clash. And I wonder, based on the fact that we're talking whether something is political versus legal, where does due process go? I mean, they could basically say we don't want to do this, and yet there are some lawmakers saying, well, what about due process? What are your thoughts on that?
Right. What's odd, I think he's Shope is definitely within his rights just to do this behind closed doors, as it were. However, when he says he doesn't want a political circus, I think this is something that would benefit everybody, not only the public, not only David Stringer, to give his kind of day in court, quote unquote, but even the Republican caucus. Look, we're taking this seriously. We don't tolerate this kind of. So I think it's odd to me that he's looking at this as a political negative when it could be a chance for a lot of Republicans and, of course, Democrats as well to condemn Stringer's behavior.
Chris, where does this rest compared to the shooter, the Don Shooter situation that happened?
Well, the Don Shooter situation was internal more. I think you had women legislators complaining and filing the complaints. It was sort of internal, and they were fighting each other on specific incidences. I agree with John. I think this is sort of a nonsense way to go, frankly, for the ethics chairman, Shope. They have hired a very good attorney, Joe Canefield, who will do a very thoughtful report, will investigate everything, but then the report will be done. Shope says he'll make it public, which is great, transparency. But then the ethics committee should hold a hearing and have it explained. Springer, far be it from me to defend, frankly, another misfit that's in the legislature. Springer should have his day,
right.
His day at the hearing. To respond, to have a lawyer respond with him and answer the charges that I presume will be made or the analysis that'll come from the Canefield report. This is, to avoid a circus. We've already got a circus. Springer himself is a circus in town right now. So I just think that it's the wrong way to go, and that Springer should get his day before the ethics committee.
Well, Chris, one of the criticisms last year with the expulsion vote of Don Shooter was that there wasn't due process. There was no hearing. And some of the folks who were voting on that, even those who voted to expel, said this is really not the way this is supposed to work. Is having this kind of investigation, then at least having the ethics committee look at it in some way, is that much of a difference, or is that just kind of window dressing in the Stringer case?
First of all, the courts have ruled that when you're going to look at expelling a member, that is a political decision, and the legislature, the body of the House or the Senate, can can handle it any way they want to. There is no rule for this. But I think appropriately, the ethics chairman has asked Canfield to do the analysis and report back. That'll be made public. It's just that final step of whether you have a hearing of the ethics committee and let the person being accused or commented on be able to defend themselves. That just is sort of a fairness issue that I think eventually the light bulb will go on and Shoup will go that route, frankly.
John, do you think that in theory the ethics committee, if they're having this report commissioned, do they need a full-blown hearing? Would it be sufficient, do you think, if they just made the report public and then allowed Stringer to and or his attorney to respond to it, and then the ethics committee says, yes, we vote, you know, we recommend punishment X or no punishment?
I think if they wanted to handle it that way, it would be fine. They don't need to do a public hearing. I think it would just be going the extra mile. You want to get the public informed on these things. Not enough of the public is informed on local politics, unfortunately, and this is a good chance for people to see it in action and something good to happen. I think the Don Shooter situation was a little different because who knows what he would say in a public hearing against his accusers. He kind of had a habit of speaking his mind, let's say, and you wouldn't want to make people who had already suffered suffer more. But this situation, I think it's an opportunity for both parties, for the citizens, for everybody to hash this out in public.
Guys, just a few seconds before the break, Chris, does Stringer survive this particular session? Does he survive his two-year term?
Boy, we've had, as I said, it just seems like more and more of what I call the misfits getting elected. Why the mainstream media doesn't look into their backgrounds, and we get to look at this before they get in, I don't know. I think finally the Republican caucus in the House, which is just 31-29 now, they're going to be a little more sensitive of this and the racial slurs, et cetera, and the bigotry that's been expressed. I wouldn't be surprised to see them knock him out of the box because it is a safe district and they'll appoint another Republican in his place. So I think his days are numbered.
Great. John, briefly?
Yeah, I agree. I think his days are numbered. I think we have moved on from the days of Joe Arpaio, et cetera, and I think Republicans want to put any kind of rhetoric like that or even indications that somebody has racial sexist views like this, it's just not tolerated.
That's John Gabriel. Also here is Chris Hurston with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Back with more of the NewsCap talking about the Phoenix mayoral race after this.
Good Friday morning. This is KJZZ's The Show. We're in the midst of the KJZZ new member drive. That's Steve. I'm Mark. We hope that you'll take just a couple of minutes while we're taking a quick break from the insightful analysis of the Friday NewsCap. Make your gift of support in support of your public radio station, KJZZ. Takes just a couple of minutes at KJZZ.org or by calling 888-774-9150.
This is a great time to call in and make your gift of support right now to see, you know, the NewsCap is something I look forward to every Friday, or I really look forward to it because these people are so annoying. The things they say just really frustrate me. Whatever the case may be, call in and say, hey, this is interesting. This is interesting with a twist. Whatever the case is, call now and support this kind of program and this sort of in-depth civil discussion that a lot of you love. Call now, 888-774-9150.
And the reality is that when you invest in KJZZ, you get immediate returns. You either learn something new, you get a different perspective, you connect with our community, you connect with the world. Feel good about listening. Join our group of supporters who help keep KJZZ on the air. If you haven't made a contribution or maybe you'd like to increase your gift, go online to KJZZ.org, go on the mobile app, or call 888-774-9150.
And there are so many opportunities for you to learn something new every day here on KJZZ. When you get up in the morning to listen to Morning Edition, you drive home with All Things Considered. In between, you listen to the show and learn so much about what's going on in this community and this state and in this region. That's part of the specialty of what we do, whether it's finding out what's going on at the Navajo Generating Station, the possible Rosemont Copper Mine in Tucson, or the latest art exhibition at the Phoenix Art Museum. We've covered it all in just today's edition of the show. So please put a dollar value on that listening. Realize how important your contribution is. And go to the phone now and call 888-774-9150.
And don't forget that if you do that before 6 o'clock tonight, you're entered to win the Microsoft Surface Pro. It is a convertible laptop / tablet. It has a touch screen, a great keyboard cover, big fast processor, lots of storage and memory. The kind of thing that maybe you wouldn't buy for yourself, but if you could win it, hey, you're not going to turn it down, right? I mean, you wouldn't. I wouldn't turn it down. Would you turn it down, Steve?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm more ethical than you are. We'll have to have TJ Shope look into this. Okay. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure that's really within the purview of the ethics committee. Okay. Maybe a different type of ethics question there. But you don't have to worry about ethics because you could win this thing fair and square. All you have to do is go to KJZZ.org, go to the mobile app, or call 888-774-9150.
And whether you're a relatively new listener or you've been with us for decades, you know you can count on KJZZ to bring you the latest news that is informed and accurate and credible and unbiased, the kind of service you're not going to get anyplace else. So be part of this. If you want to renew your membership, that's great as well. If you can't remember the last time you called in or made a contribution, now is a great time to do it during the spring new member drive. 888-774-9150, KJZZ.org, or the KJZZ mobile app.
With everything going on at the Capitol, with politics both in the city of Phoenix, we'll be talking about the mayor's race in a minute, everything going on at the in the legislature, it's tough to keep track of everything. You hear a lot of what's going on the show, but isn't it nice on Fridays to hear from thoughtful, insightful people who really know what they're talking about, give you their opinions, and put that sort of news in context? That's the kind of information and programming you're supporting and investing in when you make your gift right now. Make your gift. Get entered to win the Microsoft Surface Pro. KJZZ.org, 888-774-9150.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Arts Center presenting Monterey Jazz Festival on tour, featuring Grammy Award winner Cecile McLaurin-Salvant and Christian Sands, April 9th at Mesa Arts Center. Tickets at MesaArtsCenter.com.
Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Our panelists today are Chris Hurston, public policy consultant and editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com, John Gabriel. John, I will give you a chance to talk about the Phoenix mayor's race, but I know this other panelist right here, Mr. Hurston, is itching to talk about this. So, Chris, is Daniel Valenzuela a Republican now?
That my understanding is he's still a lifelong registered Democrat, Valenzuela. And, you know, it's interesting. The mayor's race is supposed to be nonpartisan. But the runoff has become quite partisan, mainly because Valenzuela lost to Kate Gallego by 16 points in the primary. And the Valenzuela camp, which is heavily supported by the business community and by APS and by a lot of traditional Republicans, they brought in Republican consultants and operatives, McCain operatives, mm-hmm. frankly, that ran John McCain's campaigns. And so now we see towards the end of the race, we see them appealing to Republicans, and Republicans are saying they're getting phone calls from robocalls and from other people saying, vote for Danny, he's the Republican, which is sort of comical how this is happening because he's not a Republican. But clearly Valenzuela believes that's a lane he had to go into to have any chance to make up the difference. I don't think it's going to work. I think full disclosure, I voted for Kate Gallego and support her. But I think Gallego will win, and I think she'll win solidly.
But is it a tactic that makes sense to you, Chris, considering where Valenzuela's at based on the runoff?
It makes a little sense. I don't think deception ever makes sense. Okay. So I think calling and telling people that he's a Republican, independent expenditures that are doing this and so forth, that's never right. But I think Moses Sanchez was one of the ones that lost, a Republican, mm-hmm. and a Libertarian lost from the primary. They were eliminated. And so I think Valenzuela's attempt to grab that vote is all really he could do, considering that Gallego won so easily in the primary. Also, I think Valenzuela's crew is hoping for a very low turnout so that the police union and the firefighters that are backing Valenzuela will have more impact. But I just don't think it's going to work. I think Gallego has run a very good campaign, and I think she's going to win.
John, does it make sense to you, though, that this is a nonpartisan race, but clearly the two finalists are Democrats? Does it make sense for the business community to decide that Daniel Valenzuela is their guy?
It seems quite odd, especially just choosing him. If you look at the records, they're so similar. And I think one of the things that, as Chris has mentioned, is Valenzuela is just desperate to set a division between them. Look, we're different, because if you look at their voting records, it's so similar. And Gallego is more of a known quantity to Phoenicians. So it'll be interesting. I was kind of confused that all this business people getting very partisan acting about this, because I'm like, would it really make that big a difference? I can see there are certain issues that he would slightly support more than Gallego. But I think Gallego, one of the few big issues on the Phoenix news beat lately has been the Phoenix Suns arena, and I think she's with the public on that.
It's interesting because up until recently, it seems like that was sort of the dividing line between the two of them, where Valenzuela was supportive of the deal and Gallego was not. Is that, I guess, from Valenzuela's perspective, is that just not a big enough issue to really move the needle in terms of differentiating himself from Kate Gallego?
Well, I think he knows it's not a terribly popular idea, too. And that's kind of interesting, too, because in that case, on that issue, I would think more conservatives, libertarians, Republicans would side with her than they would with Valenzuela. So I think he's putting up a valiant effort. But I agree with Chris that I think it's Gallego's race to lose.
Mm-hmm. Chris, let's talk a little bit more about what you think about the Gallego campaign specifically, because you said you think it's been well run. There have been people who have criticized her ads, though. I mean, her specific ad, which worked really well in the primary situation, but not necessarily in the runoff. It's that same ad where she ends it with her son. And some people have said, well, okay, I respect the fact that you're a professional woman who also is a mom, but is she pushing that too much considering she would be the mayor of the fifth largest city?
No, I don't think so, because more women than men will vote. Okay. And I think stressing the fact that she is a single mom and that she is a well-balanced professional as well, and that you can do both, I think that's very alluring to female voters. I think all you have to do, frankly, and maybe the majority of voters don't, is watch the debates. Kate Gallego is, in my opinion, she wins every debate because she's so knowledgeable in the issues. And I think her understanding of the issues and ability to talk about the environment and so forth, that's her background, her education. I think that plays very well to a more professionally oriented constituency as well. So I think the female factor and her discussion of the issues, and she, you just get the feeling, which is why I voted for her, that she's going to be more independent. That, and this is what I think frustrates the business community, that she's going to listen to all sides, but she's going to vote how she thinks what is best for the city of Phoenix, and the establishment gets nervous around her. I find that very appealing.
Chris, you mentioned that the Valenzuela campaign is expecting a low turnout election. It seems like that's not an unreasonable expectation, given it's the middle of March in an odd-numbered year. Yeah. What kind of turnout are you expecting?
I think it'll go. Remember, the primary was tied into the general election.
It was on election day in November.
And so there was, over 300,000 votes cast. I think now we're going to be down to like 120,000 votes cast. And so it will be a lower turnout, which means that organized entities like the police union that support Valenzuela will have probably more impact. But I just don't think it'll be enough. I still think I think Gallego will win by 10 points, frankly, which would be a huge victory, but we'll see. Low turnouts make candidates nervous, and I can understand that.
John, do you also anticipate low turnout? And if so, how does that affect the role that some of the unions and the really well organized entities might play in the outcome?
It will. It raises their influence a great deal. So, especially public sector unions, they are the ones who get out and vote when the rest of us are like, "Oh, I'm busy picking up the kids or rushing. I got to work late," and just don't get around to it. And these kind of oddly timed elections, a lot of people, just run of the mill people, don't even think it's an election day. So, I think it definitely helps the public sector unions get the vote out, because they're the ones who really care about these issues.
But we do have this thing called mail ballots, early voting, and that still will be even more dominant in this election. They don't even use the regular precinct process for election on Tuesday, the actual election day. They use voting centers. There's less of them. So I don't know what the statistic is. My guess is 90% of the votes cast, if not more, will come from mailed-in ballots. And most of those have already been cast.
Yeah. John, next up, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and I want to make sure we get to the fact that Scott Bayles has decided to retire as Arizona's Supreme Court Chief Justice. And this gives Governor Ducey yet another chance. We still don't know who he's going to pick from this short list to replace the retiring John Polander. There had been concern that with seven now seven justices, that Governor Ducey can really put his stamp on that. What's your balancing act on that one, considering merit selection does narrow it down, but he does have the ability to shape the court?
Oh, definitely. And this is why I was kind of frankly surprised that the Democrats didn't seem to focus more on the governor's office the last time around. He really will, and part of it is his retirements. Yes, the court has expanded, but his imprint is going to be all over this court for the next couple decades, I think. He's picking people who are fairly young, fairly about in the middle of their career, and it could have a definite big influence. I think he has to pick good people, though. But the only people he's going to pick from are people who in the past had been considered conservative, originalist, constitutionalist, textualist. And these are the people that anybody else isn't really going to be considered that much. And with his latest departure, that's the last official Democrat on the court. So.
Yeah, Chris, as we wrap this up, I was wondering about, you know, your thoughts on this generally, because the merit selection does narrow it down. But the one big name we saw that got eliminated in that first run was Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery. Now, he, based on the fact that he was one of the 11, will get a chance at this next crack. Do you think that's too much of a political football for the governor to jump in on? Or is there any possibility that he did pick Clint Bowlick? Obviously, they're very different in terms of their careers, but their points of view maybe aren't that different.
Well, yeah, I think that's the fascinating thing to watch. Don't get me started on the packing the court and the expansion to seven.
Just a few seconds.
I just think that's ridiculous. But anyway, and Ducey got exactly what he wants now. He'll get five of the seven appointments. I think I have a hunch Montgomery will get sent to the governor in the Steve Twist, John Kyle, Kathy Herod. The governor owes too much to all of them, and that Montgomery will end up, in my opinion, tragically taking Scott Bayle's position.
Wow, that's something to watch. You always make bold predictions. We love that.
What's my track record?
It's good.
Okay, then I'll keep making
it. Okay, public policy consultant Chris Hurstam and John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com. Guys, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.